Hey guys, I'm Jackie Brubaker, host of the Love You Even More podcast. I'm an author, performer, producer, and Emmy Award winner. Each week, I bring on inspiring people and experts in their field to have powerful, motivational, and enlightened conversations about relationships, self-development, and how you can love yourself even more. Follow us for daily updates at Love You Even More Podcast and at Jackie Brubaker on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. For more on myself and the podcast, including ways that you can love yourself even more, go to loveyouevenmore.com. Welcome, Allison Hare, to the Love You Even More podcast. Allison is a professional women's coach. She is helping women become more in alignment with everything that they do so that they can lead better, more fulfilling, aligned lives. And today we're actually going to talk about her birth story and birthing stories. There's a lot of talk right now about women and having babies, labor, mortality rates. A lot of stuff is going on right now. And Allison has a really inspiring story and a lot of knowledge on this. So thank you for coming. Allison, I like to let people introduce themselves a little bit more because you guys do such a good job. So if there's anything you'd like to add, please go ahead and add.
I think you did a great job. I'm the podcast host of Late Learner. And I host a mother's group called the Effective Collective. It's like a non-business mastermind for business moms. So that's predominantly what I do. I left my corporate career last year. I was in technology sales for over 20 years and was so unbelievably burnt out and left it without a plan and saying, you know what, I've got to burn the boats and do what lights me up and figure out a way to live, work, and play and make money in full alignment. So That is what I've done. And I'm grateful to be here, Jacqueline. Thanks so much.
Thank you. All right. So let me hear your story about your birth story that was pretty intense. How about it?
Yeah. So, my husband and I got married when we were both 37 and we found out we were pregnant on our honeymoon. Oh, gosh. So I was 38 when I had my son, and it was one of those things where I had too much amniotic fluid. Mm-hmm. And what happens, I think in general, you know, the statistics show that 33% of births in the U.S. will end up as C-sections. And, you know, I had a really healthy pregnancy. I loved being pregnant. And towards the end, they had too much amniotic fluid. And essentially, they said, you know what, let's take them out early. Let's get you induced at 38 weeks. And I was like, great, I'll get to meet my baby earlier. Everything has been, for the most part, smooth sailing. And I was 38 years old. I mean, I'm ready, right? And it got to a point where I was truly forced into a C-section where they had broken my water. You know, they had broken my water at 12. And at 5 p.m., I was 5 centimeters dilated. Wow. And then by 8 p.m., I was still 5 centimeters dilated. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you have two choices. It looks like it might be failure to, I forget what it's called, but
launch?
It's kind of failure to launch, but it was like, I don't know, where they're like, you can either have a C-section or you could wait. But if you wait, you could risk infection, you could do this and whatever. And, you know, I was hopped up on drugs. I had an epidural. I had everything. I couldn't feel anything at all, except for these emotions of, you know, I went in thinking, unless death is imminent, I don't want a C-section. Please help, you know, like all the birth plans, you know, you tell the midwife and the doctor and all of that. And, And they just kept pushing. They kept pushing. And it, I remember watching the movie. I don't know if you've seen the documentary. It's called The Business of Being Born. Ricky Lake had done this. And so, you know, I got the standard, and again, a new mom, a new pregnant, new pregnancy, never been pregnant before. Everything was just, well, if things go wrong, I'll just handle it. You know, just trusted that I was in the right hands. I'd been with this physician, the OBGYN, for 14 years. She deals with birth day in and day out. Why wouldn't she know best? And I just felt like, I remember feeling like I don't really have any power here. They gave me the choice that I could wait, but they said, you know, if you wait, you know, we may not be here because of shift change, or there might not be a surgery room later on because it's around Christmas. You know, like it was stuff that was just really,
wow.
And I didn't feel supported at all. And then they said, you know, because the water is broken, you risk infection. And I was like, oh, well, I don't want to infect my baby. I guess we'll have to do it. And I was crying, and it was like a teaching hospital. So there were all kinds of people around, you know, like there was the physicians, there was a midwife, my mom, the Jason's Deli guy came to deliver to my mom while this was going on.
And there were, much.
Yeah, there were students there. They're all like circled around me, and they're looking at me going, what are you going to do? And I'm crying. I'm throwing up. I have tons of drugs in me of just, you know, the epidural and all of that stuff. And just nothing felt right. And I remember the one line from that documentary of Ricky Lake called The Business of Being Born. And it said that the majority of C-sections happen before 10 p.m. at night, because that is when shift change happens. And my baby was born at 8:48 p.m. And I remember going, am I a statistic? Like, is this really happening? Mm-hmm. So they did the C-section. My son was whisked away, and I had no idea he was in the NICU. There was nobody around. I didn't know where my husband was. I didn't know where my mom was. It was crazy. And he ended up being in the NICU for 9 days. He was just simply undercooked. You know, he was just undercooked.
That's a sweet way of putting it.
Yeah. And he was in the NICU for 9 days. He never latched, so I couldn't breastfeed. So I had to exclusively pump for 9 months. And, you know, all things considered, he was healthy, you know, so I wasn't really angry. You know, it was just like an unfortunate thing that happened. And when I got pregnant with my daughter, we went through a lot for my daughter 2 years later. We did IVF to get her. And I remember asking my doctor, I really, you know, could I have a vaginal birth? And I wasn't, yeah. And she's like, no, we don't support that. And so every single doctor said, no, because you have had a C-section, you need another one. I also had another surgery called myomectomy, which is like a removal of fibroids. Mm-hmm. So I had additional cuts in my, you know, abdomen area, which, you know, adds to increased risk. And at the same time, I was 40. And so I was like elevated risk. So C-section, myomectomy, 40 years old, pregnant with a second child. And every doctor is telling me I absolutely need to have a C-section. And that C-section is probably going to be around 36 weeks gestation. And remember, my son was born at 38 weeks, just small. He was 6 pounds. And I found one doctor, and he was known for doing VBACs. There were only two. I live in Atlanta. There were only two that do vaginal birth after a cesarean, or that support it. And he did. And he's like, I'm looking at your records, and your body can stand the trial of labor if you want. And I was like, well, do I need a C-section? And he's like, do you want one? And I'm like, are you a quack? I mean, what's going on? And he said, you know, I know it's hard to hear because you are probably used to you go to the doctor, ask question, doctor tells you what to do. But in this practice, we believe in shared decision-making. And, you know, what I'm seeing is we're going to closely monitor you. And if you want a family-centered cesarean, we will honor that. If you want to have a vaginal birth, we'll support you. If you change your mind, we will support you. If you want an epidural, we will support you. Mm. But if I tell you you need a C-section, you need one. Until then, the choice is yours. Wow. And I was like, oh my God. It almost felt like the amount of stress that I had through that pregnancy, trying to have a different birth, having a different experience, and wondering, I'm going so far against the grain when four doctors told me I had to have a C-section. Mm-hmm. And I remember I have a friend who was also pregnant and she had a water birth with her first child. And she's an attorney and very smart. She wasn't like the crunchy granola, you know, kind of person that is all airy fairy. And she was the one that kept saying, I think there's another way here. And I remember we were both at Flywheel. I don't know if you remember Flywheel. It's Rip Flywheel, rest in peace. But it's like a spin class. And I remember we're both pregnant. We're on the bike at 6 a.m. And before we're chatting, and I was like, I'm so stressed. Like, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing. Am I with the right practitioner? There's only one person in the city that's told me I could do this. Am I being insane and, you know, putting myself and my baby at risk? And I asked her, like, what did the water birth give to you? Why are you so proud of it? And she said, you know, when you go through something like that, I felt like it's so painful that once you do it, you can do anything. And I can't even tell you how many things I would have been so scared to do. And because I did that, I felt like it gave me the courage. And I remember being so angry and like pedaling my ass off during that class that I felt like it was robbed from me.
Yeah.
And I felt like, why? You know, why can't I have that experience? Mm-hmm. And so as the pregnancy went on, I kept trying to have more of a neutral thing of like, you know, I'm in great care. They'll take care of me if something changes and I have to have a C-section. And by the end, I just desperately wanted it. And so I ended up having, you know, my daughter was breech, and this doctor did the manual rotation, wow. Which knew very, like, he's a triple board certified doctor.
Yeah.
Nobody does that either, that manual rotation. And it worked where she was heads down. Like I had too much amniotic fluid, same exact conditions as my son. I was 40, had more risk, you know, of uterine rupture, which is the big, you know, I mean, obviously it's catastrophic if it happens. But I ended up having a med-free vaginal birth and I had it at 41 weeks gestation. And the reason why I say that is because they would have taken her out at 36 weeks otherwise. And at 41 weeks, she was only 6 pounds and 15 ounces. And what was so beautiful about it is this particular practice, when she was born, they didn't cut the cord for 3 hours. They just let her stay on my chest for hours, just me and her. And you know, my husband was there too. And just the feeling of her, everything was healing. It just felt like it was so miraculous and healing and such a different recovery from the C-section, obviously. And, you know, it kind of leads into what I've learned since then. You know, she got to latch and breastfeed and do all that kind of stuff. And what I started to realize is that the C-section is so common and that it's typically done on the doctor and the facility's calendar, not moms, not babies.
Yeah.
And it made me so frustrated. you know, I didn't have a med-free vaginal birth because I wanted this earthly, you know, kind of airy fairy kind of experience. I'm not that person. It was an FU to my first doctor. It really was. And in my case, I got so fortunate that it worked, but it got me thinking about how many mothers lose their ability and lose their voice when they feel like something is wrong. And I don't know if blindly trust their doctor, but how do you not trust your doctor, right? Mm-hmm. But understanding or experiencing what happens when the convenience takes over from what the baby might need, yeah. That the any sign of risk, I mean, I'm not a medical professional, but any sign of risk, it immediately goes to C-section. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, again, in my case, it was considered emergency C-section, but understanding that the very same conditions the second time were there, mm-hmm. plus some, and I was able to do it. And so I just got this sense that why don't we know what OBGYNs or medical maternal healthcare practitioners, why don't we have access to what their C-section rates are? And I don't know that moms feel empowered to push back and ask, what is your C-section rate here? And why is it so high? And I remember asking my OBGYN when I was pregnant with the second one. And I asked her, you know, why is Northside a hospital? This particular hospital where I had my first baby, it was a different one, the second. Why is there so many high risk scenarios there? Well, it's the best hospital. It's got all of that. But I wonder how much of it really is that high risk that in 1970, 10% of mothers had C-sections. Now it's 33%. Have our bodies changed that much?
Yeah.
And then the maternal health mortality rate is rising now. I mean, it's 2023. Why is that still happening? Yeah. So something seems to be off here.
That's a huge point. And I feel like obviously the mother mortality rate, especially of women of color, is huge. And a lot of people are fighting for that to help mothers stay alive and to help their babies stay alive, because they should be after having a baby. It shouldn't be this high. But the biggest call to action is, why are doctors not listening to women? And why are they forcing you into something that you don't have all the information for? You are trusting them. I think it is a little blind, you know, you're hoping you've picked the right doctor. You know, a lot of women interview a few doctors before they choose one. And, you know, I don't think this happened to you, but it could have if your doctor had been on vacation, you know, or wasn't available the day of your, you know, first child's birth. Then what? Then you get somebody else that you've never met before, and how would you trust them? And you have a birthing plan. I always hear, nurses joke, they're like, oh no, yeah, they come in with birthing plans and we just rip them up. I mean, or you should just rip them up because you just can't predict it. And I think especially for a first time mother who is considered a geriatric pregnancy, it's you need some sort of reassurance. You're hoping you're getting that with your doctor, but you're also hoping you get that from, you get heard, that you're heard for what you would like to see happen. With your first doctor, when you were asking questions before the C-section, did you feel heard?
I didn't know any different. Mm-hmm. So there were no alarm bells. And when I thought, great, I'm going to be induced 2 weeks early, I get to meet my baby early. Yeah. I just trusted it, you know? Yeah. And I talked to a lot of moms that are pregnant and they're like, it's almost like, la, 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 I'm in the best care. And it's funny because when you look at reviews, You want to look at reviews for doctors that many times they're like, oh, the reception staff is so nice. I didn't wait that long. And that's the measure. And I want to see the ones that are like, this doctor saved my life. This doctor saved my baby's life. And it's hard. It really is hard. There are still some kind of manipulation that happens with some of those reviews. And, you know, the medical boards are not, they are not necessarily designed to protect patients, but they are protecting the industry around medical providers and practitioners. It's hard. It's hard to find the right provider. And I think asking an obnoxious level of questions and continuously asking them, and, you know, again, they're trained to say maybe some things that kind of settle you, but I think it comes back to being in your body and just trusting your instincts. You know, I know when people are pregnant, they get a lot of advice, and a lot of times that advice is frustrating because it may not settle well with you, or it might seem bitter, or people might be forceful with it where it doesn't really seem like your type of approach. And so I do think it is kind of leaning back into your body. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if something is showing up as a red flag, you know, raise that flag and just keep asking questions and trust your body. Because again, I'm not a medical practitioner, but I wish I knew how to advocate for myself, and I did not. In the first one, for sure, I did not. My husband didn't know what to do, even though the regular Lamaze and breathing classes or whatever the birthing classes, my mom didn't know how to advocate for me. Having a doula helps. I don't know that doulas were allowed at the first, at my first birth, but I did have a doula at second, and I had a postpartum doula. It was just a totally different experience. And why would I pay for a doula? You know, why would I pay extra for that, for them to do what the doctor is supposed to do? Why don't they just do it? But it really makes a huge difference for somebody to be by your side who understands and is going to advocate for the mother. But it's just kind of a shame. It's a shame how it is.
Yeah. So, and you are all about helping women be more aligned in their life. When it comes to having a baby, especially after you've had the baby, right after, how can they be more aligned and ask better questions? Or what are some of the questions that they should ask right after having their baby about themselves and about the baby?
Here's what nobody tells you. After you have a baby, your identity shifts. Your identity shifts. Whether you experience postpartum blues or depression, your identity shifts, and it is a complete, there's no way to kind of get through it unfettered. There's no way to get through it unfettered and unchanged by it. And I think, you know, the immediate things right after you have a baby are asking for help. Everybody wants to come and hold the baby and bring presents. But what you need help with is to take a nap. You need help with the dishes. You need help with laundry. You need help with cleaning up those things and giving mom space to just process. That's the best possible thing you can do. I had a postpartum doula the second time around, and that's what we paid her to do. We paid her to help us with breastfeeding and wearing the baby and clipping nails and bathing the baby. But mostly she was there for me. And, you know, because I had a 2.5-year-old son, that I wanted to make sure he felt like he was loved and cared for, even though he didn't really understand what was going on at the time with the second baby. We wanted to make his transition better. So we had somebody in the home advocating for all of us as a family, but mainly for me, and that she would take care of the baby so I could take a nap. You know, it's having your body go through that hormonally, physically, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, all of the adrenaline, all of the hormones. I mean, they're just wild. And you're not sleeping. And so the amount of depletion is great. But I think the identity part that happens after, where you know, like for me, I took a different route where it was really important for me. And this was all ego-based. I think I was in a different space where it was so important for me to be the mom that didn't skip a beat. I could still do everything. I could go back to work. I had everything figured out. I could look fabulous and be back out and, you know, just have these fun accessories with me, my kids. It just... And that turned into disordered eating, botched, you know, body dysmorphia. It went into a whole different thing. And what, again, from that identity perspective, in my journey, it took me to a place that, that brought me to my knees of trying to be something that I wasn't. And that identity of like searching for, now that I'm a mom, like everyone wants to be a good mom. What does that mean to be a good mom? Am I present enough? Why am I on the phone while my baby's in the rocking chair and I'm scrolling, you know, distracted? And there's just so much that goes into not doing enough, doing too much. And then trying to be all things to everybody and figuring out, what does this mean? And I think once you have a child, your roots grow in a different way, where the experience of your identity becomes that much denser, and navigating what that looks like is a whole experience.
Oh my gosh. Go into that. What does that mean? Explain more.
Well, you know, when you're responsible for a life, again, it's such a transformation of who you are, and it's not who you were. And being a mom, trying to keep kids alive and a partner, if you have one, supporting you, and what that looks like, it just, I don't know, like just navigating through it all. It just feels like there's so much on the line. It feels like there's so much on the line. There's so much you can screw up. And the truth is, my kids now are 10 and 8. And from, you know, I've done so many podcast episodes about parenting and about, you know, there's so much stress that comes along with trying to be a good mom, a good parent, and really just providing a loving home, a loving, safe home, and a safe place to fall for your kids is like the best you can do. And all the rest of it is gravy. And we just spend so much time worried that we are doing the wrong thing. We spend so much time feeling like we can't measure up, or if our kids don't listen to us, that it is a failure. And so there's just so much judgment inherently. And so those roots growing deeper is like really kind of rooting down into, what are your values? What is important to you? How do you strip away the bullshit? I don't know if I'm allowed to say.
Oh yeah, you can definitely.
Okay. But stripping away the bullshit that does not matter, and being present as you can, and still being, I think it's more of an act of self-compassion.
Wow. I love that you said it makes you denser. Because when you said that, I could visualize it. I could really visualize if before a baby, you're kind of actually airy and sort of like floating, that would just bring you down and make you denser to be more grounded. Because like you said, you're responsible for these little babies to grow up. I know a lot of moms get really lost. Like you said, your identity shifts and they get really lost. And it's like, who am I now? I feel like my everything is towards my kid or my kids. What are some wonderful ways for women to feel like their needs are getting met, even by just themselves, because we can't expect everything from everyone else. We have to give it to ourselves.
I think it's such a smart question, because I think it's the crux of what happens, is that identity part of worthiness and that feeling of unworthiness. For me, I feel like the relationship that I have with myself, or at least having a little bit of distance from the actual birth experience, I knew there were a few things that I've done early on that kind of set the stage for a relationship. And one is that, what does it look like to put your partner's needs before your own? I'm trying to think if this will make sense. And that doesn't mean, be subservient to somebody else, but it's setting the stage for having a relationship where the joy of the relationship comes from giving on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
My husband loves when, I don't know, he's not very good at like minutiae around stuff. And so if he has a return to make, I love doing the returns for him. I don't mind making the doctor's appointments for him. And in turn, he loves to cook and I hate it. Mm-hmm. And so our relationship is different because we're constantly looking for ways to serve each other and to make life easier for each other. Mm-hmm. And so if you set a foundation of a relationship around what does it look like to bring joy to others, and a foundation where it's not always like that, right? Not everybody has relationships like that. But for me, that was really, really important early on. And what does it mean to, in our house, we will always spend money on mental health and physical health. Mm-hmm. And whether that looks like gym therapy, my husband is in his 40s. His mental health is skateboarding, and I'm serious. And my mental health is dancing. I became a dance fitness instructor at, during the pandemic after never dancing before.
Yeah.
And so finding yourself doing things that light you up and prioritizing whatever lights you up, and if that looks like making a list of 15 things that bring you joy and just putting that on your list, just put it on the list and make sure you carve out time, even if it is taking 5 minutes to go outside and notice how bright the moon is and realize how good that makes you feel. Or if you are in a heightened state of nervousness or nervous system is kind of on alert, maybe putting your hand on your chest just for a moment until you can physically feel it calm down, or going into nature, anything that's going to lower your nervous system and put you in a place where you are grounded into what lights you up is the best possible way that you can create a strong foundation and also reconnect with yourself as quickly as possible, because when you buckle up as a role of your mom, the first lesson you learn is that all the rules are going to go out the window.
I love this. I think you are just a wealth of knowledge, and thank you for sharing your story about this. I feel like we could just go on and on about parenting at this point. So maybe I'll bring you back for another episode and we can talk more about parenting. Thank you so much. If there's one thing you'd like to leave our listeners with, what is one thing they should definitely know about either having a baby, the birth process, or being a brand new mom?
I think always trust your body. I think your body always knows when you are rooted in your body, and notice if you feel disconnected or not. And so disconnection could look like, if you wake up sick and you've got a full day and you're like, I don't have time to be sick, I'm just going to plow through it. That takes you out of your body. And sometimes it's required, right? Like sometimes you just have to disassociate and get stuff done. But anytime you can get back in your body and notice and maybe put words to how you are feeling, say it out loud. If you don't have somebody to say it out loud to, write it down in a safe place, or sharing it in a safe place to kind of, once you claim it, you can tame it kind of thing, will always help you get back into your body. And once you have yourself and you're listening to your own intuition, your own guidance, you strengthen that muscle. It makes it so much easier to navigate through the world in a powerful way, in a way that feels authentic to you.
Ah, wonderful advice. Thank you so much, Allison. Tell people how they can find you.
Well, thank you so much, Jacqueline. This is such a breath of fresh air. It's a conversation I haven't talked about in a while, so I appreciate you asking and hope I was sharp enough. I feel like I rambled some, but you can edit that part out. But yeah, you can find me on allisonhair.com. My podcast is Late Learner, or Instagram is Allison_hair, Allison with two L's and an I. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. Remember, sharing is caring. Make sure to rate the podcast and leave a review. We really rely on this to help get the podcast out there.